postcard from Narvik, part two. Riding the Stambanen to the Malmbanen. In part one of our postcard from Narvik, your humble author, his wife, children and a niece, struck out for the Arctic to celebrate his late October 50th birthday. Having been there at the age of 21, this seemed the obvious place to commemorate another milestone. A miscalculation of the dates means he is also keeping five children out of school the week before half term. On the morning after our arrival in Sweden, we have woken up in a sleeper compartment and breakfasted on restaurant car dime bars. With gravity on my side this time, I have converted our flat-pack IKEA nighttime couchette back into a daytime seating compartment. Since we climbed aboard at Stockholm's Arlanda Airport Station the previous tea time, train number 94 has covered 113 miles of Swedish Railways Ostkustbanan, East Coast Line, and joined the Norrbanan, Northern Main Line, at Gävle. Heading inland, another 154 miles brought us to Bracka, after which we traversed the clumsily named Stambanen Genom Övre Norrland main line through Upper Norrland for the 389-mile trip to Boden. As we roll out of Boden station, despite having been on the train for over 12 hours and having travelled over 650 miles, we still haven't crossed the Arctic Circle and remain 6.5 hours and 270 miles from our destination of Narvik. Boden is a town of 16,000 souls close to the eastern Baltic side of Sweden. The landlocked Baltic freezes over in winter time and makes the nearby port of Luleå unusable. Therefore, another line is necessary. The Malmbanan, or iron ore line, strikes out to the northwest and eventually reaches the ice-free port of Narvik in northern Norway. This allows for the year-round export of iron ore from a mega mine at Kiruna. Upon leaving Boden via the Malmbanan, the hour hand is touching 7 a.m. and the sun is peeping above the eastern horizon. It is time for the children to reach for the ice by books I prepared to keep them occupied on the long trip. Paul Circlen. While counting trees, they are also ticking off sightings of reindeer, frozen lakes, snow sheds, laps and different types of rolling stock. Added to which is a photograph of an Arctic fox badge and a line of white painted rocks for them to guess the significance of. Excited children ask, is this to do with the Arctic Circle? What's the Arctic Circle? Where is it? What's it for? The Arctic Circle is a line of latitude lying at 66 degrees 30 minutes north, I inform them. The southern limit of an area within which the sun does not rise. On your grandfather's birthday, the 21st of December. If you do not believe me, ask the guard. Having found and pestered the guard, the children return wide-eyed. The grandfather they never knew having been further elevated from motorcycling mountaineering hero to latitude legend. In the way Swedes do, the guard had also rambled in explanation about midwinter, the angle of the Earth's axis, and the Tropic of Cancer. Typical Scandinavian over-attention to detail, best ignored, I reassured the little ones. By which time, we are thundering past the lumber village of Mergek, population 51, and it is time to hand out the Arctic Fox badges to our first-time crossers of what the locals call the Pole Circlen. Decades ago, there had been an initiation. An English travelling gentleman, about his 21st birthday, would be rolled naked in the snow, doused in elk urine, and sodomised with a hard-boiled egg. In these more snowflake times, no such initiation occurred. Nothing at all. Even the outside sign announcing the polar circle had gone, as had the white stones strewn along the latitude. Rather, a modest explanatory poster stood in a line-side car park, no doubt including a photograph of my father, looking smug, between the twin peaks of Abisko on his Francis Barnett 1956 trials. Hold on a minute. Can any puffins of a particular generation, engaged in derring do in the high latitudes during the 1980s, put my mind at risk? Rest. There was an initiation when visiting the Arctic for the first time, to appease Father Frost, ensure husky puppies weren't born with five legs, and prevent lap children from going cross-eyed during adolescence. The duplicitous Swedes didn't only administer the boiled egg to my younger, nerdy and naive self, did they? Elsewhere, as centuries go, advancing along the iron ore line, family excitement is reaching fever pitch. The children are becoming hysterical. I have a nosebleed. The approaching confluence of crimson ore and steel rails accost us as a rising full moon might before a hungry, bloodthirsty werewolf. You see, dear reader, iron ore is in our blood. Steel wheels upon steel rail carry it through the veins. An explanation. We must return to the rural debatable lands 2 centuries previous. At the time, my great-great-great-grandfather, Thomas Worthsaying Esquire, was a gentleman farmer with, according to the 1851 census, a very impressive acreage beneath his stout countryman's boots. When he watched in pride over his 3 sons and 4 daughters, being a true Cumbrian, he will have wondered, which of these idiots is going to lose the farm? The descendants of Thomas's middle son still farm. His youngest went to a strange place called London and became articled in law, after which himself and his offspring were destined to be respectable and noted Lancashire solicitors and businessmen. My direct ancestor was the eldest brother, John, and, yes, you've guessed it, he was the one who lost the family farm in a crackpot scheme to connect nowhere to nowhere during the railway mania of the middle 19th century. His business partner at the time was a fellow landowner, a southerner, and an all-round troublesome sort. You may know of him, the Duke of Northumberland. The correspondence survives in our family deed books, stashed in the attic beneath my appropriately unfinished model railway. Although this is happening 150 years ago, the neighbouring farmer, immortalised in family folklore by selling sackfuls of crows' bodies with chickens' heads protruding, was the direct ancestor of a certain Mrs. A.W.S. As if in competition, a century and a half before, my family took our unusual debatable land's name to North America, having named their tobacco plantations, liberated from the natives, after the parishes of King George's Cumberland. They provided work for recent arrivals from Africa, generously delivered by galleon rather than dinghy. What has any of this to do with iron ore? Read on. Iron ore in our veins. Having been cleaned out by his lordship, John found meaningful and profitable employment in the nearby iron ore mines. At the time, they provided to a West Cumberland and Furness steel industry, dwarfing any similar enterprise of Pittsburghians or the Japanese. He lodged in the town of Egremont, along with 2 of his sons, and rose to be an important chap in the industry. During evenings, weekends, high days and holidays, John continued to farm on the Solway Plain. Partway between 21 and 50, I had the pleasure of being shown around the mine, when it was still working, a small amount of ore being extracted for the paint industry. The men drilled and blasted in the morning, had their bait at dinner time, and cleared the blasted ore to the service in the afternoon. Compared to the cramp, rock-hard adits necessary for lead and silver extraction and the dusty, noisy, cluttered levels familiar to the coal miner, the iron ore mine was quite pleasant. Likewise, forget about the vast chambers necessitated by salt and slate and the endless pilloried galleries required to extract gypsum. The scale underground was welcoming. As the topics of gypsum and injustice intertwine, my father's cousin was a gypsum miner. A skilled mechanic, he was required at all points underground and at all hours of the shift to keep the machinery running. As the mine approached the end of its life, every Friday for 2 years, he contributed to a whip round for the leavers. But when his time came to finish, there being nothing remaining except himself and a confusion of machinery to be switched off and made safe, there was no whip round for him. A message there. Back on my visit to the family iron ore mine, there was such a maze of workings, ventilation shafts and chimneys, many of them forgotten about, that a refreshing draught ran through the tunnels. Sufficient gale blew up the main shaft for one to be able to lean into it without anyone holding one's overall. By the way, do not attempt, take my word for it. As well as the shaft, there was a gentle sloping drift which allowed for an easy walk through topsoil, clay, conglomerate, limestone, topped with billions of little seashell fossils, past the fault line that causes local earth tremors, and into the leads of kidney-red hematite. As well as air running through the workings, there was a gazillion gallons of water finding its way underground from the mountains of the Western Lake District to the Irish Sea. Coal and natural gas lay close by too. Given the complex, wet and unpredictable geology, earth tremors and the presence of things that burn and explode, why do they want to build a giga-sized nuclear waste depository there? Might it be better located within the chalky southeast of England, or even in London clay? Perhaps below the House of Commons? Having ticked the Arctic Circle in our iSpy books and become overexcited by tall tales from family history, we are now on the lookout for the Iron Ore Mountain at Kiruna. At this point, I must invite Puffins to add a note of caution to what they've just read. Is there a place in the modern world for the sanguine red ore nostalgia of gentleman miners and resting railway tycoons, pushing buckets up the drifting Egremont before wandering off to deliver a lamb? Shall we break our journey at Kiruna and find out? We shall. To be continued.